Hey guys, it's Corey just dropping in before the show to let you know that we've got a live show coming up on Monday the 8th of July at 6:30 in the Pride in London pop-up shop in Covent Garden. Tickets are going on sale soon, so get yourself one and come down. Hey guys, this is episode 10 and it's a very special episode. You won't be hearing much from me this week because Luke is hosting.
Hey. Wow.
Well done.
I'm excited.
I'm very excited. I can't wait to see what happens.
I've written your intro down word for word. I'm going to be so good.
But before we get into that, I want to read out a couple emails. We've had a few, but I'm just going to read out these two because I quite like them. The first one is from Michaela Bolger. Bolger?
You got to get it right.
Michaela. Let's just say Michaela. So there's no subject, but it says, well, I don't really have anything sciencey to say because quite frankly, I'm not a scientist. I don't even like science. I just like the podcast.
That's always good.
Well, if I don't even like science. To be fair, every episode is pretty much me saying I don't like science as well.
So. Yeah, true. If we've interested you at all, that I will call that a win.
I mean, we must be pretty charismatic to manage to carry off. Like, anyway, I really enjoy it, and I wanted you guys to know. Lots of love.
Aww.
Yeah.
Gosh, if she doesn't like science, she's going to hate this episode.
Okay. Okay, read me another one.
Okay, just one more, then we'll get into the episode. This is from Zoe Anderson-Jones.
Ooh, what a great name.
Yeah, the subject title, the subject line is, you have mildly helped me.
Yay!
Just wanted to let you guys know that I, a year 9 girl from New Zealand, feel like I understand what's going on in my science class slightly more now that I've listened to your podcast, usually while walking home from the bus or being antisocial in homeroom. Sent from Zoe at my school email address because I'm in a computer science lesson right now.
Well, Zoe, at the end of this episode, if you think you know what's going on in your science class, you're going to realize you don't know what's going on at all.
And you can tell your teacher that they don't know.
Anyway, I'm glad that we've mildly helped you.
Yeah. If you guys want to hear your emails being read out on this show, just send us an email at scyguyspod@gmail.com.
That's scyguyspod@gmail.com.
scyguyspod@gmail.com. Hello and welcome to SciGuys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Luke and this week I'll be hosting the show.
This feels so wrong, but
I don't like this at all. No, this is weird.
You like being a co-host, Corey?
I don't like being a co-host, Luke.
Corey's lost control, he doesn't know how to deal.
And so now Corey is taking the back seat and he's about to give over the show to less science, more metaphysics, but it does have a very good scientific basis.
Mm. I feel so uncomfortable.
You haven't told us what you're talking about, though, have you?
Well, we'll be talking about the time-traveling twins that make up the fundamentals of reality. So I will be finishing this episode with my official theory of the universe.
But oh, yeah.
I like your universe theory.
Yeah. To get us started, here is some teasers of the importance of what I'm about to talk to you about.
Okay.
Richard Feynman said, this is the central mystery of quantum mechanics. And Jim Al-Khalili said, if I hit you with this, it basically tells you what it's all about. Which I think is quite exciting.
What do you Vague think? Yet intriguing.
I can't wait to hear more.
So in 1801, there was a man called Thomas Young, and he wanted to prove his theory that light was a wave of energy. Now, have you heard of Thomas Young,
James? No, I just said Young Thomas as if it was a rapper.
Young Thomas. Okay, we'll call him Young Thomas for the rest of the show. Basically, he was trying to debunk the century-old theory by Newton that light was a particle. And so he came up with an experiment called the Joule slit experiment. Now,
I know this one.
Have you done this in school?
We did this in physics.
Yes.
I mean,
it's
probably.
Trippy.
I don't remember that name.
So a little background on the Joule slit experiment. You may have done it in physics if you've done GCSE physics or A-level physics. Basically, what it is you get a single point source of light, like a laser, for example, and you fire it towards a material with two tiny slits in it. So that what happens is...
Yeah.
You've done this?
Yeah, I've done this.
So what happens is the light basically becomes two tiny sources of light, i.e. the light going through the slits. So each slit is a source of light. And through this experiment, you can determine whether light is a particle or a wave. Or at least that's what Young Thomas thought was going to happen.
Boy, was he surprised.
Now, if light is a wave, imagine you have some water, right? Which is a wave, right? You have waves of water. And you send water through two slits, and it becomes two sources of wavy water, right? So can you kind of infer, or Corey, can you remember from school, what happens when these waves meet?
I don't want to spoil this for you, because I do know what happens.
That's fine. You can spoil it.
Okay. So basically, when you've got waves, you've got constructive and destructive interaction.
Interference.
Interference.
Yeah.
So if you've got waves that are both like going the same way, and like they're in sync with each other,
they become double.
They become bigger.
Double. Yeah. Doubly.
Whereas if they are destructive, then they're out of sync,
and they cancel
each other out.
Yeah. Yes. Perfect. So that's the key thing about a wave, is if you were to have something that is a wave, you would see constructive and destructive interference on the wall that the light eventually hits. So it goes from the laser through the slits and to a wall or a screen or a detector, whatever you want to call it. Now, if it was a particle, it would behave differently. So for a particle, imagine you've got a cannon that fires out marbles through slits, right? So can you imagine...
Sounds really fun.
How big are these slits?
They're the size of a marble. That's actually a really good point.
That's a really good aim.
The slit is the same width as the wavelength of the light that you're mm-hmm. shooting through it. And so, James, can you imagine what would happen if you fired a load of marbles through some slits?
A very few of them would get through the slit.
Yes.
And a lot of them wouldn't.
Would bounce off.
Yeah.
Yes. But what would you see on the wall or the screen or the detector behind?
Oh, I don't know. Like a few.
So what you'd see is... Sorry, I'll just tell you.
I don't just tell you that. A few
this
marbles?
Reminds me of being back
so
in school.
So what you'd see is marbles that went through the right slit would form a very specific line of marbles on the right.
Where the slits are.
Yeah. And the ones that went through the left. So you'd see two lines... Very specific lines, and mm-hmm. that's it. And with the constructive destructive wave pattern, you get a wave pattern, which is you get bands of high intensity and low intensity. So in the center, you have high, and then you have nothing, and then you have slightly less high, and then nothing, and then slightly less high, and nothing. And so those are a wave interference pattern and a marble going through a slit interference pattern. The hypothesis of Young Thomas was that light is...
Sorry,
every time.
Young E.T.
is that light is a wave. And when he ran his experiment, he shone a source of light through two slits. He saw a wave interference pattern on the wall. And so he took that as evidence that light's a wave, right? And he disproved Newton's idea that light was particles. Corey,
I'm just surprised that no one had ever tried to do this before in history and noticed.
I think it's quite a specific thing. Also, it's 1801, so it's not like you have loads of access to like really precise machinery to make these little slits.
In 1800 years, nothing had accidentally just happened, and someone had been like, that's weird. That's a weird thing that's happening.
But you have to be watching.
Yeah.
At like a tiny, tiny scale.
But people are watching all the... No, it's not that tiny.
It's because the light goes through the slits and goes onto the wall behind it. So it gets bigger. Like you can see this with the naked eye. Yeah. It's not
We could do this at home.
Yes. You can actually do it with your fingers. If you hold up your fingers and move your... I don't know. I've not actually managed to do it. But if you move your fingers so they're just tiny little slits and you get a light source, you can see the interference pattern.
Whoa, that's cool.
Yeah. Maybe I can do it with my phone torch. Let's have a look. No, I cannot.
That solves that mystery.
What fascinating listening that was for
them. What a great thing for an
audio-based
video format.
Podcast.
Now, fast forward to 1927. Clinton Davison and Lester Germer, I think that's
Germer.
Right, decided to try this experiment out with atoms, something that we in classical physics know are particles. So if you have understood what I've been talking about, what's your prediction to what you'd see on the wall?
You'd get two very distinct, lines of particles.
On the wall.
And what do you think we got?
Wave patterns,
We
probably.
Got a wave pattern, which means that atoms, in this experiment, atoms are behaving like waves, which is strange, right? So the hypothesis they came up with is that particles are somehow interfering with each other, like bouncing off of each other after they've gone through the slits, and are creating some kind of wave pattern in a way that we didn't really understand. But we can test that. So they decided, right now we're sending loads of like marbles, essentially, through these slits. So what about if we just send one marble electron at a time? You'd expect that because there's nothing for them to interfere with, they just land on the wall as... two slits.
Were they sending atoms or electrons?
This is the key thing as well. It doesn't matter what you send through. You can even send molecules through, which are like molecules made up of like 810 atoms, and they still behave like waves. Spoiler.
So it's
bizarre. Like you can it's a very strange phenomenon, and it's called wave particle duality, if anyone wants to look it up. So even when we send one particle at a time, we still get a wave pattern, which the only way you can really explain that is that if you believe that particles are particles, atoms are physical solid things, which I think we like to hold on to as a thing because otherwise we don't exist, then the particle is going through both slits at the same time, interfering with itself and then hitting the wall. James, you look perplexed.
Yeah, it's just a lot to happen in that in that space.
Yeah, so the particle in this theory is splitting into two and interfering with itself and hitting the wall as a wave pattern.
Has this got something to do with quantum mechanics, wherein it's doing both at the same time because both are equally likely?
Wow, Corey, you really are taking my role on the podcast by ruining what's about to be said. And this is scary because, I mean, this kind of scares the scientists because, like, if electrons are waves and atoms are waves and molecules are behaving like waves, I'm made up of atoms and
molecules
and particles.
So this is a wave.
Okay, for the audience,
people at home,
Corey is waving.
He just waved.
Hilarious. So the scientists thought, okay, if we think that the particle is splitting in two and going through both slits, then we could be a little bit cheeky. And so they set up, we love a cheeky scientist on this podcast, don't we? They set up.
That bloody Thomas was cheeky, wasn't he?
Cheeky young Thomas. They decided to set up a detector right next to one of the slits so that they could detect whether the particle was going through that slit. What do you think happened? If you know, don't ruin it. But what would you expect to happen?
Well, you're looking at the wrong person.
Okay. I mean, I would expect it to go through one slit because it collapses into...
Well, you only know that because you know where the story's going.
I don't know where the story's going. I just know quantum physics because I'm smart.
What they would have expected to happen is that you would get a 50-50%... If it's a particle, you'd get a 50-50% rate of it going through each slit. So your detector would go off 50% of the time next to one slit. And that, is, in fact, is exactly what they experienced, which then... rules out that the particle is splitting in two and interfering with itself when observed. And so this is the really key thing, is that what they then saw on the wall is they saw two slits, two lines, two distinct lines, which means in some spooky way, the particles know that they're being watched and change their behavior. Just like me when I make a YouTube video. James is looking very disturbed.
I don't know if you mean that literally.
Literally.
I never know with you.
I do mean this literally. This is literally
what happens.
They know
they're being watched.
That's why you can...
As it, they behave as if they know they're being watched. If you send the particles through, they behave in one way. Okay. And the moment you start looking at them, they behave in another way. Right?
This is related to why you can know the speed of an object or exactly where it is.
But
not both at the same time.
Are we talking about observing it on the wall, like a naked eye, versus the detector, which is...
No. In this case, the detector and the wall match up. When you decide to detect, the particle...
So what do you mean by looking at it, then?
Sorry?
If we're still looking at it, what do you mean by when we stop looking at it?
When we stop looking at it, I stop making the observation, stop measuring where it's going.
Right, okay.
Am I explaining this really horrendously? Do you have any questions?
But we're still watching
because
where it's going.
Right now, you will be the audience. The audience might not understand what's going on.
I don't...
So when you're seeing it come off... When you're seeing it on the wall, you're not observing the particle itself.
Yes.
You're observing something that's happened because of the particle.
Yes.
Right.
So it's measuring it indirectly. Yep. There's direct measurement, which is observation, and then indirect measurement, which is seeing it on the wall.
I suppose what I should try and explain a little bit of is I should try and explain to you the idea of the collapse of the wave function. So
that's a good place to start.
So this is a part of quantum mechanics, which says that when observed, before it is observed, a particle it exists as a wave of possible states. So like if you fire the particle at the slits, it exists where it hit the wall and bounced off. It exists where it went through the right slit. It exists where it went through the left slit. It exists where it went through neither. It exists where it went through both. All of those possibilities exist.
Yeah.
And when you observe the particle, as in specifically the particle, making a measurement of the particle, it decides which one it did by some bizarre thing that we don't understand. But this is the thing, that's not even the start of it. So the science... One,
I have a feeling this is going to make less and less sense.
I was about to spoil this and then I realised what you said earlier.
So the scientists are very keen to not rely on anything that they don't understand. And so they tried to come up with a new hypothesis. And the new hypothesis was, okay, we're making a measurement. Maybe the fact that we're making the measurement is interfering with the experiment in some way, right? And so we don't want to affect whether the particle goes through the left or the right slit. So what they decided to do was they decided to take their detector and put it after the slits, right? And so in this way, the particle has gone through the slits as a wave and is going to make a wave interference pattern. Mm-hmm. And then they're detecting it after it's already done that. So what do you think they saw on the wall?
I've no idea.
Okay. Well, what they saw... I get this is hard to follow. I apologize.
It's very hard to follow.
It's a terrible idea to let me do an episode, Corey. So what they saw on the wall, and I'll tell you why it's significant, is that what they saw on the wall is they saw two slits, which means they know that when they fire particles of light through, or light through a slit, it behaves like a wave and goes through both and interferes with itself.
Right.
Okay. Then the detector is detecting it and it's deciding to act as a particle, but it's still making a pattern as though it went through only one of the slits. And so the only conclusion you can draw is that the particle went through the slits as a wave, then found out it was being detected, went back in time, then went through as a particle in just one of the right or the left slit, and then went forward and hit the wall. That, I...
Okay.
or that the particle knows beforehand whether it is going to be detected. And I use the word knows in a very loose sense. Like, I'm not saying that the particle is conscious. It's just that it seems that the universe and these particles behave in such a way that they know the future and make their decision before the thing that's happened that will affect them has happened.
This is really difficult to conceptualize because we see time linearly.
Yes.
But they clearly don't.
Yeah, you have to understand that, I mean, what this says to me on a fundamental level is that everything that has happened or ever will happen is also happening right now.
This is the multiverse theory.
Mm. Yes.
This is the basis of it.
I don't know if I'm just not visualizing the experiment correctly.
Okay. Shall I backtrack for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so which part are you not? Do you not feel like you're not understanding?
I don't understand how... What changed between...
By the way, you don't have to feel bad that you don't understand this, because...
Oh, no.
Nobody understands it.
I know.
There is no answer to this yet.
Going into this, I was like, either there's going to be a really simple explanation like diffraction or something, or it's going to be impossible to understand.
This is literally quantum physics.
Yeah.
the famous quote about quantum physics is, if you think you've understood quantum physics, then you haven't understood quantum physics, because nobody does. So let me just recap for you.
Okay.
So you fire particles of anything through slits, and they interfere with each other, and they make an interference pattern.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that waves interfere in water.
Mm-hmm.
Two high bits of wave join to make a higher bit of wave. A high bit and a low bit join to make zero.
Yeah.
And so you get bands of high intensity and no intensity across the wall.
Cool. Yeah.
Then, if you...
Got that.
Yeah. If you fire them...
The
one
change
at a
confused me, I think.
Okay. Then, if you fire them one at a time... They still produce an interference pattern, which means they are interfering with themselves. Then, if you observe them, they stop doing it altogether.
Yeah.
Like the universe, like these particles are going, oh, the human knows which slit we went through.
Yeah.
We have to just go through that one slit. Like, because they can't understand, we mustn't let them understand how the universe works.
It's like being in a video game when it has to render something that you weren't supposed to, that you're not supposed to see.
It's like, oh God, we haven't
and
done that
then,
yet.
Yeah. If you detect it after it's already meant to have gone through as a wave, it will retroactively go back and go through as a particle.
Fix itself. Okay.
So
when you fire them at one slit, they act as particles and no one knows why.
They act as waves and no one knows why. Unless you observe them.
Unless you observe, okay.
So it is the act of observing, the act of measurement, that means that they go through as both. And so now the scientists...
Can we clarify what we mean by observing? This being...
So observe is just you observing anything, but because we're big, we can't observe an individual atom, so we have to use a detector to observe it.
Okay, cool.
Right?
Cool. Right. On board.
Okay. Let me just find my
I think...
This is so complicated.
It is so complicated.
You really bit off a lot here.
Yeah.
I can see time.
I feel like no one's going to listen to this episode because they're going to get about 5 minutes in and go, what?
They probably got to that point where
Remember
I was like,
guy, Luke is not sexy from the internet. What's he doing now?
Let's just put a fun bit from
this might
middle
be
of
most
the episode
popular
at the start.
Episode. Remember that guy that did that video, Spicy Tampons? Listen to this.
Here he is now.
So the thing, another way I can explain this to you, which is helpful, and that people, it's in popular culture, so people will maybe have something to link onto, is that you have a thought experiment called Schrodinger's cat, which is
I was going to mention this earlier when you said it exists in a state of...
which is to say that if you put a cat into a box and you set up a piece of apparatus which relies on radioactive decay, which you don't have to know about, you set up a way...
we do know about.
We talked about
because
it.
Because of our old episodes.
Oh, yeah, cool. So you can go back and listen to that. You set up the box in such a way that there is a 50-50% chance that the cat will be killed, but you can't tell if the cat's dead until you open the box. Therefore, before you open the box, the cat exists in a state where it both is and is not dead. That the cat it exists in a thing called superposition, which is in the state of dead and it's also in the state of alive. And when you observe it, you turn one of those realities into reality.
Into reality, yeah, yeah.
And so that is why making the measurement of the particle is the same as us observing it, mm-hmm. because it also works in the thought experiment of just looking at the cat. The act of observing the cat, in the same way the act of detecting a particle, turns that into the reality.
Reality, right.
And before you observe it, all possible realities exist. So!
Oh my god.
Now, the last thing the scientists wanted to try and eliminate was to make sure that their detector wasn't affecting the result of the experiment. Now, specifically, if you want to look it up, they were trying to make sure that they weren't affecting the coherence of the waves, which is the way that the waves are in a predictable state that they left the detector in. Because if their detector is changing that, then they can't say that they're objective. So they came up with this thing called the delayed choice quantum eraser, which I'm not even going to try and explain to you. I do understand it, I promise you. And there is a video in the description of a source that is very good by PBS in America that explains this thing called the delayed choice quantum eraser. Now,
give us a brief.
Yeah,
give
us a little.
Yeah, it's not something I can really explain without a diagram.
I imagine it's like a lecture.
Yeah.
I'm just imagining a big rubber.
Basically,
that
what
doesn't
it is.
Exist?
Ooh,
but it does exist.
Wait, a big rubber?
An eraser?
Oh no!
The disgust.
Basically, the system was this: it is a way of running the experiment of firing any particle through two slits and measuring it in such a way that completely randomly, 50% of the time, you will destroy your measurement. Let me explain that a little bit better.
Okay.
What it is the delayed choice quantum eraser experiment is a way of making a detection in such a way that the measurement is not stored, therefore it doesn't actually collapse. Does that make sense? Because what you want to eliminate there is you're trying to find out whether your measurement is the thing that collapses it, or it's the fact that you can know the answer which makes it collapse.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
So, like, if I... It's the difference between me punching James and him entering a certain state, or me knowing something about James and making him into a certain state. He still enters the state, but I'm trying to work out whether it's my interaction with James that makes him the state, or my knowledge of James that makes him the state. Basically, what this did... I really don't want to try and explain this because it's very complicated, but it relies on quantum mechanics. It relies on entanglement theory, which is the fact that if you make a particle of one type, you also make a particle of the opposite type, and they are entangled. And if you ever try and observe the other one instantly becomes its opposite faster than the speed of light in a way that we don't understand. And so this is the thing about this experiment, which I love, is it does make you realize science knows absolutely nothing. Even stuff that science says it knows, it doesn't know.
This is how they explain in, like, faster than light communication.
Yes.
In, like, Star Trek and stuff. Using, like...
Yeah.
It wouldn't work that way.
The problem with entanglement is it doesn't work like that, in that I can measure mine,
but I can't affect it yet.
We may be able to do that one day.
But it's so cool because there's so many possible applications for that kind of quantum entanglement.
Yeah, but so much of classical physics relies on this idea of data, like information can't travel faster than the speed of light, but we also have plenty of evidence that it can in entangled particles. And so we have to adjust our theory. Either the particles always had that value, in which case no information is transferred, or information can transfer at the faster than the speed of light, or the particles have some weird way of creating a little wormhole and transferring the data at the speed of light, but through a wormhole, so it actually gets across space faster than the light. It's very, yeah.
Do you want to explain what a wormhole actually is?
Yes, please, go for it.
No, I'm saying,
No, you go for it.
Okay, right.
I'm all ears.
This is great.
I've only seen wormholes in films in which people just fall into them.
The way that people explain wormholes in films is the same way every single time. They get a piece of paper, they fold it over and stab it with a pencil. But basically, a wormhole is just as simple as you having a shorter way through space-time.
Yes.
We can only travel through space, and we travel at time at a set speed.
Well, we can only travel through our three dimensions of space plus time. But if you can fold through a fourth or a fifth dimension...
Exactly.
Then you're good.
It's like an ant on a newspaper.
Yeah,
it has to go linearly.
Yes,
but if you fold the piece of paper,
I don't think anyone's
going
to be able to understand that from what you just said.
No, that's easy to understand.
It's easy enough to understand.
Yeah, easier visually.
Yeah, like if you wanted to get from the bottom to the top of the paper, you'd have to walk from the bottom to the top of the paper, or you could just fold the paper over, and the ant can hop onto the top.
Exactly, and then it's there.
Yeah.
So basically, with wormholes, the two ends have to be kind of the same, so you can. Like send one at the speed of light.
Time gets
when you move faster, time slows down.
Yeah.
Let's leave this for another day. This is too complex. Yeah. Fucking hell.
Okay, so
could it reverse though?
You can only go back up to a point of from where you started.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Okay. The wormhole.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, no, because I did read something about how backwards time travel could exist, but it could only exist from the point
of creating the time machine.
That it existed.
Yeah.
Okay, back to the delayed choice quantum eraser.
I didn't just deduce that.
This thing. Basically, as I said, you can look it up. There's plenty of stuff in the description of this podcast. You can look up the sources that I used. I already knew this story, and then I found sources to fit my story, which is not really good from the scientific
point
of
view.
But they are like BBC and PBS and all these kind of things.
And
they're PBS videos on YouTube. So yeah, they're reputable to a certain extent. But also, I was thinking about this, and I was like, I know that we're going to get messages about this one, or I feel like we are, because this is a very contentious topic. Because as you'll see towards the end, this does veer into the metaphysics world, which is using physics experiments to describe things that physics actually doesn't really want to even entertain as an idea, like spirituality or consciousness. And that's because science is very much focused on proving the hypothesis that all that exists is physical matter and that everything is a emergent property of physical matter, including consciousness. But as we'll come to see, I don't really believe in that. And so if you're somebody who is listening to this and going, Luke's not explaining this particularly well, or he's getting this a little bit wrong, like, I understand that, and I...
Well, you're taking a very, very big topic and making it into like a half an hour podcast.
I've had to simplify it. I've spent 5.5 hours researching this. And also, the other thing I would say is that science, every few years, science goes... Oh, everything we thought we knew, that was wrong. And now we've got a new hypothesis.
It's like when we were talking about the discovery of the atom. That they were like, there's nothing smaller than us. And then...
Oh. Except maybe mice.
And then they were like, the atom, that's tiny, smallest thing. And then they're like, oh. No. But protons, though.
Protons.
Ugh.
As I said, I'm not going to fully explain this without visual aid. But you'll have to a certain extent, you'll have to trust me. And you, if you don't trust me, you can check the sources. What it does is it makes a measurement, and then 50% of the time, it destroys that measurement. And when you do this, what you find is the times when the measurement was successfully measured, particles behaved as particles. And the time when the measurement was made but was destroyed because of the way that the experiment is set up, And destroyed is sort of if you go and research it properly, what you actually find is that it's not destroyed the measurement. It is just produced in such a way that we can't be certain of where the which slit the particle came through. This is all around certainty. If you make the measurement in such a way that you can be certain the particle went through that slit, then the particle did go through that slit. It's almost like your ability to know something makes that reality.
How do they make it uncertain? They just have them both light up at the same time?
So the way they do this, I will explain it a little bit because that's quite an easy question to answer. The way they do this is they create a set of entangled particles. Don't need to know what that is. Don't worry. And then they send these particles are directly connected to each other. And they send one of them to interact with the detector, go through the slits and interact with the detector the traditional way. And then they send the other one, which is entangled with that first particle, through a system where it goes through a set of mirrors that are only 50% reflective. So 50% of the time, it will go through to a detector where we know for certain which one it went to, and 50% of the time it will go to one where we don't know. So in effect, the measurement is destroyed. And what we find is when we measure it and it can be recorded, then it behaves as a particle. And when we measure it and we can't be certain which slit it went through, it behaves as a wave. And the really key thing is, that's really bizarre about this, is that the particles hit the detector in the traditional way before they get to the thing that decides whether the data will be kept or destroyed. So the particle behaves as a particle or a wave before it's even been decided whether it's going to be a particle or a wave, or that we will make the measurement. It's almost like it hits in any way it wants to, and then it goes through and we either make the measurement or don't, and then the other particle tells its twin particle, oh, the human knows we were measured, go back in time and behave in this way.
But go back in time from our point of view, when really from the particle's point of view, it's probably gone. It can take any path through time that it wants.
It can take, yes, exactly, but it has to match up to its twin. So at this point, the way I have read this experiment and the way that some theoretical physicists and quantum mechanic physicists have read this experiment is that you've eliminated that the particle is a light, sorry, that the light is a particle or a wave. You've eliminated that matter is even physical unless it's unobserved. You've eliminated that your interaction with the experiment is changing the experiment. And you've made sure that the fact that the data is recorded is what, or the fact that the data is conveyed to you, because it doesn't have to be recorded, it doesn't have to be saved to a hard drive, it just needs to be shown to you in such a way that, like, for example, if it goes through the right slit, then a light lights up.
Yeah.
It's not recorded anywhere physically other than in your brain and in your...
Yeah.
What that says to me and what that says to many people, and it is a very hotly debated topic, is that in the world of quantum mechanics, in our understanding of the universe from the quantum level, consciousness is part of reality and they are mutually dependent. Because if you have a physical system, it doesn't exist until it's observed by an observer. And if you have an observer, there's nothing for them to observe if there isn't physical reality.
Could you not then use this experiment, say, using a rat or something? So whichever side lights up, you train a rat to go to the side with the light. So you separate yourself from, like, you know, the rat detector.
Yeah.
And you look at the outcome.
So you maybe set it up so that a treat comes out of the slit that yeah. It went through.
Yeah. Or not even that. So you set it up so you basically train a rat to go to whichever one lights up.
Yeah.
And then you don't look at that at all, but you look at the wall, let's say. So you see what happens on the wall, and then you turn around and you look at the rat, and you see what's happened to the rat.
Yeah.
Would that not then prove consciousness of...
Animals. I don't know.
Because...
is the answer to that. Because it also works if we log the data on like a hard drive or something. So it doesn't really prove the consciousness of animals. It just proves that animals are able to make data processing.
Or maybe it proves the consciousness of computers, Luke. Never thought of it that way.
No.
So the data just needs to be recorded and stored then.
Yes. If a certain measurement is made and that is conveyed to anything, it behaves like a particle.
So what about if you forget what happened? Then it's no longer stored.
Superposition.
And then, yes. it can change back. That particle like goes back 70 years in time and changes
undead
again.
Cats. Schrodinger's cat is again.
So there's a couple of undead explanations for this. You have the many worlds interpretation, which is that there are many parallel universes in which the marble or the particle or whatever goes through all of them. And when you choose to make an observation, you collapse yourself into the parallel universe that you chose to be in,
mm-hmm.
which is... I mean, if we've got parallel universes, this is already something pretty big to deal with.
Well, we're not talking about this.
That's what the film Donnie Darko deals with,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
So Donnie Darko has that whole thing with world lines and stuff as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or you have the idea that every particle in the universe is connected so if we store the information in any way in the physical property of the entire system is changed, which, again, is not really liked by standard models of physics because it requires faster-than-light information travel. Which is not ideal because that opens up a whole new can of worms where time travel is possible. And like, that's another whole thing. Like, this basically answers that age old question of if a tree falls in the forest and it doesn't, and nobody's around to hear it, does it make a sound? The answer is, according to these experiments, it doesn't. When the tree and the forest are unobserved, they exist in a state where all the trees are impossible superpositions of having fallen down, and when somebody observes them, the forest makes up its mind as to what it looks like.
I love this.
The thing that kind of got me thinking about this when I was doing my research is, like, so we're told, for example, the universe is 13 billion years old, and as far as we know, we're the only life, and our planet is the only life harboring planet. But if the universe has been around for 13 billion years, and for some of that time life didn't exist, then it didn't happen.
Did it exist?
Because nothing was there to observe it happening. It's almost like reality comes into existence when observed.
But what bothers me about that is that we're made up of reality. We are the universe. So it
didn't
exist.
Our bodies are the universe.
But it didn't exist.
You don't know that we're the universe.
Yeah, but if it didn't exist until it observed itself.
Yes.
So, okay.
I understand this is frustrating. This is why I did the episode.
Okay, let's go back down to the smallest scale. Let's say that the first observation was the first life form that had a light sensitive patch on it.
Yeah.
That grew into our eyes, right? The first life form that had a light sensitive patch.
Yeah.
That could observe, you know,
any measurement.
Yeah. Any measurement. Is that when the universe existed in this model then? Is that when it came into being?
I honestly don't know, Corey. I think that's the point.
Or what about a system wherein you've got the first DNA and RNA? I'm gonna try and be careful about getting too complex. You've got the first DNA and RNA, the first building blocks of like life, creating the first, say, gene that's reactive to something, the first enzyme that reacts to a stimulus. Yeah. Is that when the universe began? That's ridiculous.
In my
opinion,
how
could it get to that point?
Yeah, well, exactly.
If it didn't exist beforehand,
and this is where you get into these logical loops where you have to just accept that you probably don't know the answer, or you're asking the wrong question. And so my answer to that would be that we're thinking about consciousness and matter in the wrong way, and that actually matter does exist, and it is also observed, and that the universe is observing. The fact that the universe exists. The universe is the observer as well. It is the matter and it is the observer. And you are all part of that. And so what I suppose this, to me, debunks is it doesn't say 13 billion years of time didn't exist. It doesn't say... What it says is that consciousness and matter are fundamentally linked. They require one another in order to exist. And so consciousness and what you are, or the I, not your body, your I, the self... is a fundamental property of the universe. And that, to me, is much more empowering than the line we're told in physical science that you're basically a little worthless piece of shit on a rock.
I mean, it makes sense, doesn't it? When you think about it, we literally came from the universe.
We are the universe.
We are the universe.
I like that people think, oh, we came from the universe.
It feels like
not gone anywhere.
It feels like such a dumb thing to say otherwise.
Though. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, no, we're completely separate from the universe. We just exist in it.
But we do think of ourselves as being different and existing in it, but we just are it.
Yeah, we're just part of it, yeah.
Going around and doing...
We're in it, but we're also part of it.
But here's something. So the universe, you're talking about it being 13 billion years old, or not being it, or it not mattering how old it is,
yes.
Because there was nothing around to observe it. But we can observe the universe from 13 billion years ago.
We can observe, yes, we can look 13 billion light years away.
We can, so you know that like, because light only travels a certain speed, it takes a certain amount of time to get here.
We could see out to the edge of it.
We can kind of look... way, way far out. In fact, we're still getting background radiation from the Big Bang. So we can still record the Big Bang.
I'm not saying that the universe isn't 13 billion years old. I'm just saying that if there was no one to observe it, then time is not relevant.
But what I'm saying is that because we're observing it now,
yes,
in a sense, it has to have existed.
Yes.
As in it could retroactively, it now has to have existed because we're observing it.
You bring the past into existence by observing the present past.
Which is brilliant.
Yes.
The way I'm kind of thinking about this is that the way I'm trying to understand it in my brain, because I'm not the most sciencey person, is that if there's no one around to observe it, the universe goes into like a sleep mode where like when we sleep and we're not observing anything, sleep goes like really quick. So time is irrelevant when you sleep because you don't really observe time. So,
yes.
So if there's no one in the universe, no one in the universe to observe, like quotation marks, no one in the universe to observe what's happening. Time becomes irrelevant, and when time is observed or light is observed, whatever, that's when it becomes relevant.
A good way to explain it really, really simply is if you've ever played any video game, the video games that you play, the entire world, every single map isn't sitting there ready just off screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got to be rendered. So it's there kind of stored somewhere, but as soon as you walk onto that part of the map, it spontaneously comes into existence. Mm-hmm. And the universe works like that as well. As soon as you're, like, if you're not observing something
obvious,
in any way,
it's most obvious in
it
a game
stops
like,
existing.
It's most obvious in a game like Minecraft, where you can literally see it in the distance, like loading.
Yeah, exactly. You can see it load in, and that's just. That's what happens to the universe,
whereas
but we can't see
some
it.
Games are so quick that it feels like everything is like what we exist in.
I have a fun story about breaking the simulation. I was once lying in a park, and I saw a plane in the sky, and I couldn't hear it. And I thought, why can't I hear that plane?
Mm.
And as I had that thought, it made this. It started making a loud plane noise, but it wasn't making the noise before I thought it. It was very weird.
So strange.
It was so strange. It was really freaky. Okay, so I said at the start of this episode that I would give my theory of reality, which I'd like to put out there in case one day I'm proven to be right and I'm a genius in retrospect.
So strap in, kids. This is a big one.
So this is what I think is going on. There are no laws of reality. Nothing is fixed. When the universe spontaneously comes out of nothingness, because that's what science tells us it did 13 billion years ago, it exploded Poof. Out of nothing, out of infinitely dense nothing. All things were possible. And are possible because it came out of nothing. If it came out of nothing, it is nothing. And so all things are possible because nothing is there to make nothing not be able to do everything. And so all possible things are laid out as waves of probability and of possibility across infinite space. And we are the observer choosing what to manifest into reality. So all things exist as possible states of waves of probability. And we observe things, we choose what to observe, and those things become reality. As well as that, I believe that science will never fundamentally understand reality. Because these experiments prove that as soon as we try and measure reality, reality behaves differently to how it actually behaves all the rest of the time. And so we will never know the answers to the universe. We will get more and more complex prediction models, which is what science is. It's a bunch of prediction models, and it tries to infer why, but will never actually understand. And that is okay, right? I think that's okay. And at the end of the day, like, if we came out of nothing 13 billion years ago, and anything is possible if it came out of nothing because it's just made of a load of nothing and consciousness is the only thing that exists to bring it into reality, then why would you ever think that, like, anything is not possible? I personally went through that period of my life where I was like, oh, okay, our government and our scientists know pretty much everything. And I believed that we are a physical system and I'm a little worthless piece of shit on a little rock.
We're like 98% there.
Brian Cox told me on the telly that that's how it works. And school told me that that's how it works. And why do you believe any of those things? Because
nothing wrong with Brian Cox.
As I said, every 5 years, science goes, oh, we actually don't know anything. We've got a new theory and we think it's right. 5 years later, oh.
Forget that.
We don't know anything. So that's my theory of existence, is that everything is possible because it all came out of nothing. It's one big dream and you're choosing what you observe.
It is like one big hallucination, isn't it?
I also think the universe
is hallucinating itself.
I also think that we are all the same person.
You did tweet the other day. You tweeted, what did you
tweet? We've been speaking about this so much off air.
Where you tweeted, everyone's the same person.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, because I had this weird thing where I just suddenly felt like I am you and I will live your life and you will live my life and you have lived my life and I have lived your life. And everything I've ever done or everything I'll ever will do is also happening right now. All of time is happening right now at this exact instant. And we're all the same person.
Because every possibility, because there's waves of probability, basically everything that could possibly exist does exist.
Is existing.
Now, because this is down at a quantum scale, because everything is possible, we can get to a point where every person is every other person. Because it only takes a certain number. It's like 6 degrees of separation. How many changes do you need to get before I become Luke?
Yes.
Not that many on a
not
quantum
scale. Not that many in the grand scheme
of things,
really.
In the grand scheme of things on a quantum scale, not that many.
Not that many.
So you are essentially the same person.
Yes.
Even if you think of it in alternate universes.
You could change something to where planets don't exist at all.
You could.
Or stars don't exist or...
Yeah, and that's the thing is we often hear in science, we hear like, we live in a Goldilocks zone or we live in like, the laws of physics are perfectly set up to form galaxies and form planets. And I think that's not true. We happen to be observing a patch in space where that is true. But actually, there's a dimension of gravity, where gravity has different values. Mm-hmm. And there's a dimension of light, where light travels at different speeds. And a dimension of the strong force, where if those things even exist, they might just be manifestations of an even more fundamental law.
I do love that. I love that kind of things that scientists say, where, yeah, we're in the perfect place for life to evolve. Are you dumb?
Weird. I'm so sorry. Weird that we're here to observe that.
it's very funny that you can be so self-centered as to assume that the only way that life can exist is the way it exists for us.
Yeah.
And that nowhere else in the universe can it happen at all.
Oh, we got so lucky that we decided to develop here in the Goldilocks.
It's almost it's like saying, it's so lucky that like there's so much water around fish since they're able to breathe it. Like, that's really lucky for them. As though they didn't adapt to being in water.
And I always find it very sad when we're told things like consciousness is an emergent property of the universe. It's just interacting in your brain, because that's not true, in that like my experience of the world is all that exists to me, and in my experience of the world I'm the center of the universe, and in your experience of the world you're the center of the universe, and so from your perspective it doesn't matter what the outside world tells you, because you are the center of your universe. Now that's not to say become arrogant, it's not to say become entirely selfless, it's to say like just give yourself a bit of a break. You don't have to listen to all this stuff that tells you that you're nothing. Because at the end of the day, for your entire... It's like that thing I said in the podcast, which you said sounded really arrogant. When I said about the 80s... Oh,
there's always a joke like that.
Because for my life that I can remember, that's all that's ever existed. And at the end of the day, science can say, oh, the universe is 13 billion years old because we look and there's 13 billion light years away, there is matter. There is background energy of the universe. But you have no idea that the universe didn't just spontaneously start to exist now in a state that looks like it's 13 billion years old. Mm. And so to think that you know anything, I know that science this is the thing. Science is set up to us as trying to find out the truth. That's not so much what it does. What it does is it tries to find out prediction models for the future. In that, it might stumble upon the past and it might stumble upon truth. But at the end of the day, these experiments show that as soon as you observe the universe acts in exactly changes. The way you don't expect. And so how can you ever expect that you will ever ever know anything about the universe? That's my message.
That's good. Very wholesome.
But that's not to say it's not to say it's a negative thing. It's just to say, like, you're alive and you are existing. So obviously the universe is all right because you don't have to exist. So, like, you can be told all these things about how the world works, but at the end of the day, you exist when you don't have to, and it's very unlikely that you ever would. And yet you do. And so, well done. Get on with your life.
Well, if I didn't, I wouldn't be around to observe
exactly.
It,
so. So you have to exist, because if you didn't exist, you wouldn't not exist.
You wouldn't not
exist. Therefore,
you
wouldn't
know that
you would exist again.
You couldn't know that you don't exist.
Exactly.
If you ever think, hey, I might not... Oh, no.
Yes.
Like, you exist. As soon as
exactly.
I think, therefore I am.
Yes. Your existence is inevitable, because if you didn't exist, you wouldn't not exist. That's a double negative. You exist again. Wow. Well done.
I think what's really nice is that you hit on a point throughout this whole thing that it's definitely something that I try to cultivate with this podcast, is that if you want to be a scientist, it's not about seeking the truth or being the smartest person. It's about being someone that's able to admit that they are wrong about a great many number of things, and they will always be wrong until the day that they die about a great many number of things.
Yes.
And you can never know everything, and the goal of it isn't to know everything, it's to try and get a little bit better.
Yes.
Just tweak it a little bit and try and understand your experience a little bit more, because you want everything and you'll never...
maintaining that you know nothing.
Yeah, you don't know anything. Look, I can guarantee you that maybe at least 80% of the things that you think are wrong.
Absolutely.
Probably. 100%, oh, I'd go more than 80.
At least 80% of the things that you think right now, 100% wrong. You're wrong about it. Get over it.
Yes.
You're going to be wrong. That doesn't matter.
Cry me a river.
Well, thank you for listening to my extremely chaotic episode of Sci Guys.
You're wrong. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to my chaotic episode of Sci Guys. You can find the full references for this episode in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday. And why not leave us a nice wee review? You can find and contact us at SciGuyPod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com. You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
I'm not Corey everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
That was dreadful.
No more guests.
I'm so sorry.